Welcome to the Living Waters Church podcast.
Well, good evening. As Doug said, you can open your Bible to John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2. Don't open to John because I'm not going to preach out of John. That'd be interesting, actually, if we did that. I'm excited to share tonight. I really think that all week Jesus has been speaking to me about how important the passage that we're going to be in tonight is for us in our walk with him and our faith, in our Christianity. And so I want to encourage you, even just in this moment, to really ask Jesus to speak to you through what we're going to walk through tonight, because it's really the crux of Christianity. It's what everything really rides on for us. So I'm excited to get into it. It was fun this morning, and I think it's going to be fun tonight. We're talking tonight, we're starting basically a new turn in 1 John, where we're continuing on his vein of thought about the future, but we're also talking about the family of God. So we're going to unpack what it means to be a part of the family of God over the next few weeks, and we begin tonight by talking about the Father heart of God and what that means for us. Last week, I believe Monday, I guess it was Family Day, and I hope that some of you got to spend time with your families or even with friends, but maybe you didn't. This is going to sound incredibly cheesy, but for Christians, every day is Family Day. And I can barely say it because it sounds so cheesy. But it is 100% true. It is 100% true that if you are a Christian, you are a part of a loving family. Whether you're aware of that or awake to that or not yet, you are a part of that family. And it's a beautiful revelation when you understand how loved you are and the kind of family that you're actually a part of. So that's what we're going to be walking through tonight and for the next few weeks. Last week, Doug walked us through a passage that was notorious and kind of difficult to understand. It held some scary words like Antichrist in it that was a little bit frightening. But really, what came out of that passage was a remembrance for us again that the divinity of Jesus is absolutely essential for us. That his historical death and resurrection is totally paramount to our faith. And that without the divinity of Jesus and his literal death and resurrection, we have nothing. Paul says if we don't have the divinity of Jesus, if Jesus isn't who he says he is, we might as well just pack up and go home. If Jesus isn't who he says he is, what's the point in the way that we've been living? You know, we're to be pitied amongst all people. We've thrown our whole lives into this Jesus person. And if he isn't who he says he is, then what's the point? And so the divinity of Jesus is absolutely crucial for us. And what we wanted to understand last week was not that we can't ask questions of our faith. And not that we can't, you know, discover and explore and kind of scrutinize what we understand. That's totally welcome in faith with Jesus. But when we begin to chip away at the bedrock of our faith, which is the divinity of Jesus, his historic death and resurrection, really we're not going to be left with a whole lot. So standing on the truth of who Jesus is absolutely paramount to us. And we cannot waver in that. That is what it means to be a Christian, is to believe that Jesus is who he says he is. As C.S. Lewis said, you know, he's either a liar, a lunatic, or he was telling the truth. We believe he was telling the truth. So, Jesus is God. It's highly important. We're talking about Jesus all through 1 John. John is convinced of this, and today we start to talk about Jesus in relationship to the family of God. So, chapter 2, verse 28, John says this. He's talking about the future, and he's bleeding into talking about being children of God. He says this. Verse 28, chapter 2. And now, dear children, notice the language and notice how much he's going to say children throughout the entire passage. And now, dear children, remain in fellowship with Christ so that when he returns, you will be full of courage and not shrink back from him in shame. The language that we hear in 1 John is similar to language that we see in the Gospel of John. Words that Jesus used. Jesus said, remain in me and I in you, or abide in me and I in you. This remain language is key for us. Jesus used pictures in John 8:31 and chapter 15, verse 4. He said, I am the vine and you are the branches. Stay rooted, stay connected to the vine, and you will find life. But apart from the vine, there is only death. So life, nutrients, genuine joy and peace, it all comes from Jesus, and we must be deeply connected to him in order to truly know what life is, what life's supposed to be. Jesus said, I come that you may have abundant life and know it to the fullest, life now and in the future. And he says the way that we find that is being deeply connected to him, personally connected to him every single day. I've noticed in my own life and in the lives of a lot of my friends and a lot of the people that I speak to sort of pastorally and listen to and counsel, that much of the time we struggle with sin and brokenness in our lives and walking away from darkness because we're trying to do it all by ourselves. We think that Christianity is just some sense of heightened morality where we're attempting to stop doing all the bad stuff in our lives. And so we cut out all of the bad stuff, or we attempt to cut out the bad stuff, and we don't do anything else other than avoid the bad stuff. Where this is not the core of the Christian message, just stop doing bad things. The core of Jesus' teaching is to be connected with him, be a part of what is going on. And so our sin struggle and our attempts at getting out of sin completely miss the mark. When Jesus says the reality to finding life and to moving from darkness into the life or into light and from death into life is being a part of life with him, connected to the vine. It's less about stopping all the bad things you're doing, and it's more about enjoying the divine relationship. And that is something that so many of us wrestle with, the concept that we can enjoy the divine relationship. It's something that we talked about actually at our men's retreat last weekend, which I love that came up as we're talking about John and some of 1 John even. This idea that we will have eternal life with Jesus, but we can have it right now with him as well. Life full of Jesus will push everything else out. All of the brokenness, all of the sin, and this is really what John is getting at. Since we know that Christ is righteous, we also know that all who do what is right are God's children. This is what he says in verse 29. John says that we are really highly impressionable creatures, aren't we? There's a lot of things going on around us that shape who we are. Have you ever had that moment when you think something or you say something or you do something and you go, oh, I sound just like my... It's interesting what people say. You can figure out all your parental issues because of how we respond to that question, right? Because we realize in the moment, wow, they've really shaped who I am, right? And John understands that. Since we know that Christ is righteous, we also know that all who do what is right are God's children. When I was in my first year of university, I was working at an athletic store. And it sold some sporting goods, but most of the time it sold stuff that was more about like athletic fashion. And it wasn't like tennis fashion or soccer fashion. It was more like football or basketball fashion. So there was baggier clothing, kind of on the gangster ghetto side of things. So I fit in really well there, right? I sold a lot of stuff in that store. And I remember when I first got hired there and I walked in and I saw the wall of shoes, of which most looked absolutely ridiculous to me. And I remember thinking, I am never in a million years going to put one of those shoes on. Like they're just nuts. Like, look at them. We actually had one shoe, and this was like 8 years ago, that had, like, it was a sneaker that had fur in it. So some of you who know that culture, apple bottom jeans with the boots with the fur, right? Like, we had the boots with the fur. We actually had them. And I remember looking at the boots with the fur and going, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. Why would you play basketball with fur in your boots? This doesn't make sense. Anyway, I worked there for 4, 5, 6 months or something. And around the fifth month mark, all of a sudden, something strange happened. I started looking at some of these shoes and thinking, you know, those shoes do kind of make sense. I think I could pull off boots with fur. I think that would be a good shoe for me to wear. Which is ridiculous. It would be awful. The fact that I was surrounded by this culture, though, day in and day out, just made such an impression on me. The authority figures in our lives make such an impression on us. I sound just like my... We realize that we are impressionable children. All of us, even as adults, we're constantly being shaped by something. And John says that if we're truly God's children, we'll be shaped by the life of Jesus. There's a great story in the book of Acts, Acts 4, where Peter and John, after Jesus has died and resurrected and gone back to heaven, decide that they need to preach and teach about Jesus. They need to tell people the truth of what they've experienced and the life in him. And they're also healing people. So they heal this one person, they preach about Jesus, and the religious leaders at the time are not happy about this. And so they drag Peter and John in front of this council, actually the very same council that had Jesus crucified. And they say, stop talking about Jesus so much. And he said, we're sorry. We believe in Jesus, the same Jesus that you crucified, but this is the Jesus who rose to life from the dead. We believe who he is, and we're just not going to shut up about it. Later in that passage, Luke writes that the leaders realized that these men were men who had been with Jesus. And Luke is telling us two things in that. He's saying, yeah, they recognize that they were Jesus' disciples. They may have seen him around. But he's also saying these were people that Jesus had rubbed off on. These were people that had Jesus' spirit now in them, bursting forth. And they couldn't hold that back. Jesus had made such an impression on them in 3 short years that there was something that just came out of them. And essentially what we hear from John is what we hear from the other disciples all through the New Testament. And that is that our lifestyle will be defined by the lifestyles of those we are closest to. Our lifestyle will be defined by the lifestyle of those that we are closest to. And this is what it means to be a true child of God, to be defined by God in that way. John continues and moving into chapter 3. Verses 1 through 3. See how very much our Father loves us, for he calls us his children, and that is what we are. But the people who belong to this world don't recognize that we are God's children because they don't know him. Dear friends, we are already God's children, but he has not yet shown us what we will be like when Christ appears. But we do know that we will be like him, for we will see him as he really is. And all who have this eager expectation will keep themselves pure just as he is pure. John in his writings leads us to understand that we can find life, full abundant life, right in the here and now with Jesus. But there's also going to be a time, there's going to be an eternity with Jesus where we look like him, where we experience life in a new and a beautiful way. Life that is free from sin and brokenness, from pain and struggle and death. And so John says this is an eternal motivation. We have a present motivation to know Jesus in the life that he gives us right now. But there's also this eternal motivation. So walking in the life of Jesus now benefits us for the life that we're going to find with him later as well. Being like Jesus matters now, because one day, for the rest of eternity, we're going to be like him in a new, beautiful way. So why not start now? Essentially is what John is saying. He says we're supposed to have this eager expectation. Can you imagine being John, who knew Jesus and walked with Jesus and saw the resurrected Jesus? And he's able to use this language in a meaningful way for us. Have this eager expectation to be with Jesus again. He's passionate about that. And when we experience and get to know Jesus a little bit, we're only going to want more of him and be eagerly expecting what life will look like right now and in the future as well. He continues in this vein of thought, and there's one main thought that comes out of this next passage that we're going to look at, verses 4 through 10. So allow me to read that for us. It's on the screen as well, as usual. Everyone who sins is breaking God's law, for all sin is contrary to the law of God. And you know that Jesus came to take away our sins, and there is no sin in him. Anyone who continues to live in him will not sin. But anyone who keeps on sinning does not know him or understand who he is. Dear children, don't let anyone deceive you about this. When people do what is right, it shows that they are righteous, even as Christ is righteous. But when people keep on sinning, it shows that they belong to the devil, who has been sinning since the beginning. But the Son of God came to destroy the works of the devil, and those who have been born into God's family do not make a practice of sinning, because God's life is in them. So they can't keep on sinning, because they are children of God. So now we can tell who are children of God and who are children of the devil. Anyone who does not live righteously and does not love other believers does not belong to God. One of the clear things that stands out to me in this passage is that John is definitely not Canadian. In that he doesn't mince words, you know? Like if a Canadian wrote this, it'd be, we know who the children of God are, and the children who are not so much children of God. John continues to write in contrast to make a point, right? He talks about light and darkness. He talks about life and death. He talks about children of God or children of the devil, and encourages us to really realize that our identity is in that we are children of God and not the children of the devil. He essentially says in this passage, look, the proof is in the pudding. If you really know God, if you're really in relationship with Jesus, then fruit will come from that. Your life will absolutely look different. He uses this born language, life language, family language, that your identity comes from the fact that you are a child of God, and the way he acts will be the way that you will act as you are shaped and molded into his image. Essentially, our identity as a child of God will manifest itself in how we live. It's about identity. It's not so much about doing right and doing wrong and doing all the good things versus all the bad things. It's about knowing who we actually are and holding on to that. If you saw the last three installments of the Batman franchise from Christopher Nolan, you might have noticed that a main theme in those three movies was identity. Bruce Wayne wrestles with his identity deeply through all three of those movies. He really, at the core of him, is founded in the fact that he is a Wayne. And a Wayne, though they had a lot of money, who they really were righteous people. They were people who had a sense of morality. They had a sense of right and wrong. This is something that was impressed on him as a young child when he watched his father and how his father conducted himself. His father says at one point in the first movie, I think, Gotham's been good to us and we need to do something good for Gotham. It's important to realize that the Waynes aren't just about money and power, but the Waynes are about generosity and love. That's the core of that family, as the story is told by Chris Nolan. Of course, Batman's parents die, and in the face of their murder, right, he was right in the middle of that, he kind of goes on this really crazy dark journey where he's wrestling with his identity. He's trying to confront the evil in the world and at the same time hold on to the goodness that he believes is a part of his family. There's this incredible scene towards the end of the second movie where Batman has the opportunity to allow the Joker to die. And really, for Gotham, it probably would have been better to let the Joker die. And yet Batman doesn't allow that. He saves him. And the Joker has this fantastic monologue where, as Batman has just saved him, he looks at him and he says, I won't kill you because you're just too much fun. And you won't kill me because of some misguided sense of self-righteousness. And though he's a little bit off there, really he's pointing at the core of who Bruce Wayne is. That even though Bruce Wayne has taken on this kind of dark personality to go to the dark places that other people won't go to, even though he faces off against the nastiest, most gruesome, most horrible villains, even in that moment where he could himself turn to darkness, he holds on to a shred of what it means to be really human and what it means to be really good and understand that right and wrong are two different things, and he wants to live on the side of the right. Because he realizes, and this is absolutely paramount to the Bruce Wayne Batman character. I didn't think I'd say that in a church service. This is paramount to him. He absolutely realizes that in letting go of that, it's not just a decision to let somebody die. It's letting go of his identity as a Wayne. It's letting go of his parents. It's letting go of everything that he truly is, his whole purpose in the world. I think we can understand this passage in that way. It's not about the right or the wrong or trying to follow some kinds of rules. It's about knowing our identity, and our actions will reveal our genuine identity. Are we children of God? Are we finding the fruit in our lives that would show us that we are children of God? About right and wrong, rule following, it's about identity and seeing what comes from that. I want to circle back to the beginning of chapter 3. We've worked to the end of our passage, and that's great, but I want to spend a little bit more time together at the beginning of chapter 3 in verse 1. Because this verse really is the hinge around this whole discussion of family. And if we don't understand or grasp this verse, we will really miss what it means to be a part of God's family. And we won't be able to apply it properly in our lives. John says, "See how very much our Father loves us, for he calls us his children, and that is what we are." Some of you might have translations that say, see the love that God the Father has lavished on us. This is crazy fancy language. This is extravagant language from John in the original language. See how very much our Father loves us. This is the underlying, this is the foundational spirit of this whole passage and all of our Christian faith, really. God's great love. Why do so many of us struggle with so many dark places in our lives? So much sin, so much brokenness. If we understand what it means to follow Jesus and be a Christian, it seems pretty straightforward. When we go back to the beginning of this passage, remain in fellowship with Christ so that when he returns, you won't shrink back in shame. The whole idea, the picture that Jesus paints, it's so simple. I am the vine, you are the branches. Stay connected to me. Be a part of my life. I'm going to pour my life into you. Cultivate a relationship with God daily. This seems so simple. It seems so straightforward, yet so many of us struggle with it. So many of us struggle with genuinely living alongside Jesus every single day, every single moment. And we end up going to places of sin versus to places of life with Jesus. Why is this? Might I suggest that our struggle, in part, stems from our view of God the Father? That we're weary or we're uninterested in cultivating a relationship with God because of our view of him. Our paradigm of God is foggy or it's twisted. And I don't think that our struggles all totally come out of daddy issues. I'm not saying that. I think sometimes we're just rebellious children. Sometimes we just choose the darkness over the light. Sometimes we do. We just choose something other than God. We have free choice. We can do that. But I do think that many of us struggle with this picture and this reality that God the Father is all-loving. And is truly compassionate, and is truly gracious, and is truly merciful. Because of the ideas that we have of authority figures in our lives, we are highly impressionable creatures. And might I also suggest that we will never fully function healthily as a family, as a Christian family, if we don't first understand God as a loving, compassionate Father. At the beginning of 1 John, we said that John's going to talk a lot about Jesus, and we're okay with that because we're a church, and churches should talk a lot about Jesus, right? Otherwise, what are we doing here? The reality is, if we're going to talk a lot about Jesus, we have to talk a lot about love. We have to talk a lot about grace, especially in a culture that does not celebrate it in the manner that we see it celebrated in the Bible. We have to talk a lot about it. I've spoken with so many people who wrestle with so many issues in their lives. And when we get right down to the core of it, and I ask them the question, how do you view God? More often than not, they have a view of God that has not come from here. It comes from somewhere else. And it's heartbreaking. We derive our view of God from someone or some experience other than Jesus. Be it a parent or a caregiver, an authority figure of some kind, a teacher, a schoolyard bully even. Images, ideas, paradigms get locked in our heads and we can't shake them. And then when we try and sing the songs that we sing and live the life that we know we're supposed to live, we struggle with it because we're not motivated to know a God that we don't truly believe is a God of love. We wrestle with that deeply. And as Christians, we have to continually remind ourselves to derive our view of God from Jesus. Christians have always struggled with this. You are not the first person to wrestle with this truth. Even Jesus' disciples, people who had spent 3 years with Jesus, seen him work miracles, hundreds of miracles, thousands of miracles probably, just amazed at this person. They've never seen, the world had never seen anybody like this. And even them, at the final meal they're having together, as Jesus is telling them the most important things before he's going to his death, one of them pipes up, Andrew, and he says, Jesus, look, I know what we've just all gone through. I know what we've all seen. I know who you are. I get all that. But just show us the Father and then we'll really believe you. And Jesus is going, facepalm. Andrew, have I been with you so long that you don't realize that when you look at me, you're looking at the Father. I'm in the Father and the Father is in me. In Jesus, we see the fullness of God expressed. The best picture of God is Jesus. The fullest revelation of God is Jesus. And it's almost too good to be true. Just a guy that lived for 33 odd years, walked around, performed miracles, essentially was killed by his government. We believe he came to life again, but this is God? It almost seems too good to be true. Paul writes in Colossians 2:9, in Jesus we see the fullness of God. So that means when we look at Jesus, when we read about Jesus in the Gospels, when we hear stories about Jesus, when we listen to his words, when we see his actions, that is literally what God is like. And it pains me to say this, but so many of us don't actually believe that. And we don't have a full trust in the divine Jesus in that way. And so we bridge what we talked about last week with what we're talking about this week. Is a belief that when we look at Jesus, we're looking at God, and we need to recalibrate, re-understand what that means. Sometimes I think pastors and preachers can feel like broken records. God is love, God is love, God is love, God is love. But we come in contact with people daily who just can't fathom that. Because to them, Jesus is over here, and Jesus is nice, and he's kind, he performs miracles, sometimes he holds kittens. And then over here, we have God, an authority figure who is probably just not interested in our lives. Where did that come from? Or God who's waiting for us to make a mistake and hit us over the head with a hammer. Where did that come from? It came from somewhere, and it didn't come from here. We need to rethink this. And so I've been wrestling with this all week. And I don't think that one sermon or one service can necessarily solve this for us or to make that impression in us. But here's my effort. I've been asking myself all week, how do we grasp this? How do we grasp God's great love for us as his children? How do we really understand how God feels towards us? How Jesus feels towards us? This has to go beyond emotion. This is about the truth of the creator of the universe, if we believe this book. So I've been thinking about this, and I wonder if we can just take a few moments and consider Jesus' literal interactions with children in the Gospels and use that as a vehicle to explore our relationship to God the Father. Children, you must know, in the ancient world, were not considered fully human. They weren't considered persons. Just like women weren't considered persons. Jesus changed all of that. He really did. Jesus came along, was the first one to really give children value. Children at that time, if a baby was born to you, and you're a father of a household, you had the option to discard that baby. If you didn't like what sex the baby was, if you didn't think that the baby was fully healthy, if the baby had some kind of deformity, archaeologists today are still uncovering burial grounds, mounds of infants on garbage heaps. Because in the Roman world, that's what happened. Babies were just left to die of exposure. And that sounds horrible now. And those kinds of things still happen today around our world. The world still desperately needs Jesus. Jesus came along and he gave validation to the humanity of children. By my count, in the Gospels, we have about 38 signs, wonders, healings, and miracles. Okay? Some of those are physical healings. Some of those are kind of signs and wonders in nature. Five of them are explicit healings of children. Five of them are also explicit healings of the blind. Three of them are explicit healings of women. And that might sound like a small number, but understand that John told us that Jesus did so much more than what we could record and write down. He was doing miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle. And so what we have in the Gospels is really just a snapshot of what Jesus did. So the fact that we have five explicit stories, which is a rather high number in the ratio within those miracle stories, the fact that we have five explicit stories tells us something. Either Jesus healed so many children that they had to record at least five, or the gospel writers are telling us that Jesus cared about children, so they were sure to mark down those five instances. I think it's probably a combination of the two. Jesus cared about children. How did he act towards children? He had compassion on children. He loved children. In Mark 10, we see this fantastic story where Jesus is surrounded by tons and tons of people. And he's teaching and he's performing miracles. And at one point, these parents decide that it's appropriate for them to bring their children to Jesus, which is an interesting thought in and of itself, right? That parents at that time would think that it would make sense to bring their kids to Jesus. There must have been something about them, right? So the parents bring their kids to Jesus, and then essentially his disciples form a ring around him, Mark tells us, and they say, "Get away, children. Jesus doesn't want to talk to children. Jesus doesn't want to spend his time with kids. Jesus has got more important things to do. Jesus has got more important people to talk to. He doesn't want to talk to non-persons. Bring them back when they're fully persons." Mark says that the disciples scolded the parents. But then Mark says that Jesus was angry with his disciples. He uses the word angry. And I don't know, in that moment, I feel like Jesus maybe just smacked one of them upside the head. Are you kidding me? You're missing the whole point. If you don't understand that having faith in God, you need to have faith in God like one of these children, you're missing the whole picture. Let the little children come to me. And then Mark says this. He says that some of the most beautiful words we find in all of the Gospels. It says that then Jesus took the little children in his arms, and he put his hand on their heads, and he blessed them. Many of us have seen this picture, or variations of this picture, so many times, and yet it's somehow doesn't compute for us. But this is the picture of Jesus. Children in his arms, blessing them, loving them, welcoming them. And the whole biblical narrative would tell us that when we understand that picture of Jesus, that's what God is like. And until we can accept that and experience that and know that for ourselves, we'll never fully get what it means to function healthily in the family of God. So we're going to sing a couple of songs, and we got like lots of time, okay? We're going to sing probably two songs. We're just going to take some time together to think about this picture, to meditate on this picture together, to remember our identity as children of God. And if you're in the room and this picture of Jesus, this picture of God has never been painted for you, this is the truth of the Bible. This is what the whole Christian message stands on, that God is a God of love and a God of welcome. And where everybody else has turned you away and says that you don't matter and you're not important, Jesus doesn't say that. God doesn't say that. God welcomes. God invites. If you've ever been abused or hurt or abandoned or forgotten or pushed to the side, God doesn't act that way. God is angry with the people that did that to you. And it hurts him. It grieves him. It breaks him. And he, in this moment, wants you to know how much love there really is for you. So we're going to sing together. And you can stay seated. You can stand. You can close your eyes. You can walk around the room. You can do whatever you want to do. I just encourage you not to close yourself off towards the end of the service, but to open yourself either for the first time or in a fresh new way of understanding the great, very great love of God that John writes about. And to allow that, allow the Holy Spirit to speak to you in that way as we close the end of the service.